I'm gonna have to edit out all of that. Welcome to Infill, where we discuss local San Francisco politics and policy. This week, it's Laura Clark of Yimby Action and
Sam Moss from Mission Housing Development Corporation
and Brian Hamlin from Carla.
And this week we're going to sort of focus on a hilarious article that came out about Norman Yee's sudden interest in family housing and his weird non-discovery that no one's thought about family housing before. It was a hilarious, if you know anything about the topic, though terrifying when you realize how many people were misguided by it, article. About Norman Yee, ultimate NIMBY, supervisor of District 11, suddenly discovering we have a housing crisis. We will link to it in the show notes so you can read it yourself, but it was absurd. And sort of talking in general about family housing and what that kind of means for the city.
Yeah, well, it's important to note that Norman Yee has no plan for family housing. In fact, Norman Yee has opposed housing for families, over the past however many years that he's been in office.
For all people. Like, he's anti-human housing.
He's anti-housing.
Yeah. I mean, being against that senior housing is also, you know, against family housing in and of itself.
Well, and especially since that what we know is that most large housing units, like three bedrooms or above, where there aren't families living them, like we think of families with either, you know, kids or grandparents or whoever living them, where that's not the case, it's often older couples that no longer have kids that are living in a 3- and 4-bedroom home with all those empty bedrooms. If they had, I don't know, retirement housing to live in, then perhaps that would free up that older family housing for actual families. That said, though, there's no guarantee of who is going to live in any housing unit. But this is the thing. You can't socially engineer which human family or household units get to live in which homes. They're upset that there aren't more kids. Well, maybe if the median price for housing in San Francisco weren't $1.1 million, there would be more young families in San Francisco.
And I think the bedroom count is also something. People get so fixated on 3 or 4, you know, bedrooms. And from Mission Housing's perspective, it's the 2 bedrooms that you can pivot the most with them. A family can grow a little bit and it can shrink. And if the kids move away, then it's still not too big. Like the 4-bedroom is just humongous. I really don't think that we need to build any of those.
Yeah, I mean, like, there's also this idea, right, that each child needs their own bedroom, which, while I grew up that way and was very thankful I didn't have to share a room, I also grew up in the, you know, in the suburbs where land was cheap and plentiful. Mm-hmm. That's not the case in San Francisco right now. So, you know, for a family of 4 living in a 2-bedroom is not some dystopian environment if the family really wants to be in San Francisco.
I mean, I to me, it feels like saying the family housing means we need this, like, single-family home with a yard, which we'll not get any more of. Those have been built. And, you know, it's just like a way to not support or oppose all housing by saying that you support this, like, mythical creature that doesn't exist.
So that's right, and I'm glad you brought that up, because
you're welcome.
Thank you, Sam. We've heard recently how, okay, the housing market is finally softened, new units are coming online, while the supply of housing isn't yet meeting the demand, it's a little less out of whack now than it was 18 months ago. But if you actually look at the disaggregated numbers between single-family homes, condos, and then TICs, tenancies in common, which are sort of look like condos from the outside, what's happening with the prices? Well, you see a slight decline in condos, a slight decline in TICs, and still increasing prices for single-family homes. Why? Well, there isn't that much more land where we can build single-family homes on. The new supply that we've had has all been mostly condos. And so there is just, like, it's just part of this sort of capital P progressive nostalgia fest where they think they can go back in time to where a young family can move to San Francisco
on minimum
and buy
wage
a home with a yard and, like, you know, and afford that. And that's just, there is no going back to that. That's an impossibility.
Well, and I would say more than that, like, that is based on a boomer's idea of what is ideal family housing that they are imposing on other people. Like, people, millennials, even when they have kids, don't want to move out necessarily to the burbs, don't want to have
having
to have
a yard
a car.
Sounds horrible. Really?
I mean, I had a little postage stamp front yard when I had a little townhouse in D.C., and we had a postage-size, you know, backyard and a postage-size front yard, and mostly I spent my time at the nearby park, which was a wonderful public park.
It's a front yard for everyone.
Yeah, I mean, the front yard was a total waste of space that, like, the only task was that I had to weed it every once in a while. Yeah. Like, I hated that fucking like front yard. Yeah.
No, I have conversations. So, like, I grew up in the suburbs, like I mentioned. You know, there's a pretty big front yard. And, you know, my father's, I mean, how old is he now? Like, 67? Like, still having to, like, mow the damn yard. Oh. Like, I joke about it. But, you know, the amount of time and effort and money that you spent, like, maintaining the yard, think of the sum total hours that your three kids spent enjoying that yard. You could have flown us to, like, you know, yep. Europe, like, every single time we wanted to go outside. And that actually would have been cheaper over, you know, the course of you owning this property.
But I think you bring crazy. Up you bring up a really good point about that. It's like the boomers inflicting their point of view and, like, their opinion about what we want. You know, they're not, there's no empathy over there. We get it a lot in affordable housing because we typically only build in transit-oriented areas, and we don't build parking. And, you know, in the Excelsior or in Forest Hill, like, that's a thing that I hear the most. Like, how could you not build any parking? This seems impossible. And they use it as a way to try to stop the building. And it's something that I find myself explaining more and more and more.
The impossible word, though, to me is key right there. Because if you go to these community meetings, it's not the case that, you know, folks are just always 100% cynical. You know, plenty of these boomers just cannot even wrap their heads around the idea of living in the second densest city in the United States without a car.
No,
they just can't even imagine. I'm like, I'm 34. I've never owned a car.
No, that horrible, I can't tell if they know that they're racist, SF4SF. Twitter account, which is like, oh my god, I still think it might be a parody account. I know you keep telling me it's not a parody
account. Well, I checked their website. Like, I thought it was a parody account at first because, like, they seem like they're so over the top NIMBY and, like,
I got caught in the web the other day.
San Franciscans.
Yeah.
Like, why don't we just, like, call it, like, San Francisco, you know, natives first, right? I mean, like, are they on, like, the Trump train,
with,
too?
With, like, a literal how many years you have to live here before you're allowed to be a native?
I've been at those community meetings.
If someone could give me that number of years, it'd be great to know what I'm striving for.
So I went when I was at a mission meeting once about the red line bus lanes. Yeah. So, like, the cutoff seemed to be 5 for some people. And I'm like, all right, I've done it. I've been here for 6 years.
That'd be great.
Authentically speak on behalf of the mission. But it just didn't work because I didn't have a car.
No, my favorite are when you get out to, like, the Excelsior and whatnot. It's how many generations. It's the whitest person announcing how many generations of San Franciscan they are. And I love it. I'm like, so your Native American ancestry? Is that what you're making reference? Yep. No.
And then so I can bring up the fact that I am, in fact, like 1/16th Mi'kmaq. But, that doesn't really count for anything. You know, the first Republican that I met in the wild in San Francisco was when I was out canvassing. And it was an older white gentleman who then talked about his family's been in San Francisco since the fucking gold rush. And I'm just like, oh, okay.
I'm like, we're building out there, like above the Balboa BART station. So I've been spending like 3 to 5 nights a week going to community meetings, and it is definitely not the mission. I will admit that.
My favorite is referring to the gold rush people as economic migrants.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which they were.
Yeah. Just think about it.
Yeah, just like today's techies.
Yeah, you know. But anyway, we've gotten off of the SF for SF because they hit the what millennials really want is to move out to the suburbs in whatever the school district and the car and whatever.
2.5 kids.
And I don't want to be like, hey, I'm pretty sure that you're not a millennial running this Twitter account. If I had to guess, like, please do not try to speak for my generation.
Laura, you're really good with meme GIFs. The fact that, by the way, they're pronounced GIFs and not GIFs really irks me.
Oh my god.
Like, okay, let's not even like go on there. All right, but. Do you have a good GIF, whatever, for millennial splaining to older people? Like, is that something that you found yet? Because we could really use
millennial splaining. That would be great.
I think just using GIFs in general is millennial splaining. Like, just they don't know where to find it.
Even
on
if
the
you
Twitter
make it, it's
app.
Not like they're gonna look at it. You know.
Oh, I love, but I do love them. They're just so rich, the SF for SF people. Oh my God, everyone should go follow them because just like the pure comedic, because you will think that it's a parody account at first. It's so good.
Like I try to explain, lately I've been, because I get asked about parking like 5 to 100 times a community meeting. Yeah. I started, you know, saying first we would rather house humans than cars.
Yeah.
And
ooh, feisty.
I mean, I
agree.
Yeah. But one couple, after they told me they were born and raised here, went to like Warmerdam or something like that. They always say the middle school where they went to.
That's when they peaked, Sam. Like they're like from here. They peaked in middle school. Like they still like remember the first story, like when they like made out with someone behind the football field, and that was it for them. It's been downhill ever since.
When I said like, you know, ma'am, of course, it was very polite. You know, I said, if you could just take a step back and think about your upbringing and maybe it was a little more affluent than a homeless senior or family, you know, you approach problems differently. You attack going to the grocery store with your car. We bring food pantry to the building. Going to the grocery store is not that important or needed. If you could just try to think about it that way. And I was a little worried that I was going to get, like, run out of the room, but the opposite happened. Like, they accepted it.
Oh, good.
So they like being treated like adults. Note to self, yeah.
It's hard sometimes.
I don't know that I can start saying ma'am and sir, though. That might be a bit too much to ask.
Got to play the game, man.
Yeah. Well, or you have to say that actually we shouldn't play this game anymore, and that...
Well, let's talk about the local zoning game now, right? Because this is something that we've been talking a lot recently, and it's in the news. It's topical, right? So we have Senator Mike Lee...
We should thank the Republicans for
that. Yeah, right. No, I mean, it's just like everything that we've been saying for the past couple of years now has been confirmed. So Senator Mike Lee of Utah... introduce a bill called the, quote, Local Zoning Decisions Protection Act, unquote.
And so awesome. They're not even hiding it.
I mean, it's like, this is like 48
so
Hills.
Good.
Like this is like something that like, you know, Bob Gunderson or some like Twitter urbanist, you know, parody account would have come up with. But then like Mike Lee says, quote, every American should be free to choose where to live, and every community should be free to zone its neighborhoods and compete for new residents according to its different values. Yeah, different values. You know, Berkeley, for instance, you know, knows something about different values. The guy who co-authored their zoning ordinance way back in 1916, Charles H. Cheney, I guess that name has been associated with evil for a great many years, you know, was specifically concerned with protecting the sanctity of white detached single family homes from these parasitic apartment buildings, from the laundromats of the, quote, heathen Chinese, unquote.
Well, it's redlining. Like, you know, the protecting local zoning is basically just going back to the days where they wanted to keep, you know, immigrants, black people, all that stuff in the city with no funds, and then move the white people out to the suburbs and then have a higher tax base.
Yeah, I mean, all of these policies were designed to keep low-income, minority, and quote-unquote undesirable people out of neighborhoods. And they're successful. Like, we shouldn't be surprised that these policies worked and that these single-family home-only zoned neighborhoods are predominantly white. And, like, the fact that now we've gotten to the point where it's so bad that they're hurting their own children is kind of this next level of damage. But the original purpose of all of this stuff was to, you know, fight back on what they saw as urban decay and what we might say as integration.
Yeah. Well, let's step back even a little bit further just to some of these urban decay arguments. You know, all the way back to the origin of zoning in the United States. So, you know, again, I mentioned Charles H. Cheney. when he was designing an area in Southern California, Palo Verdes Estates, he wrote a letter to Frederick Law Olmsted, who also co-designed it, explaining why do we have such large lots? Like, why are we zoning for this certain area? And he said, the type of protective restrictions and the high-class scheme of layout which we have provided tends to guide and automatically regulate the class of citizens who are settling here. The restrictions prohibit occupation of land by Negroes or Asiatics. The minimum cost of house restrictions tends to group the people of more or less like income together.
Just putting it right out there.
Mm-hmm.
Or like East Palo Alto.
And it worked.
I feel like East Palo Alto is a really good example. Aren't they? They can't have more housing because they don't have enough water.
That's right? One of the reasons.
And the reason they don't have enough water is because they zoned all the other people away to regular Palo Alto and took it, you know.
Yeah, I mean, well, Palo Alto has been fucking East Palo Alto for a very long time. The water is just, like, one of the ways in which they've been doing so. But, you know, again, so, like, I've read that line from Charles H. Cheney. The reason I'm doing so is the effects of zoning weren't unintentional. Like, sometimes people talk about, oh, it was segregating based on class, oh, it was leading to exclusion. These are some unintended consequences. Like, no, they weren't. That was the point. That's why we did it in the first place. And yet, we have 48 Hills, the so-called like progressive voice of San Francisco,
defending.
just this month of this year, having a headline, "The Year That Local Zoning Control Comes Under Attack."
No, this is the thing that's like, I'm so suspicious, because when you hear the words "protect our community," I think it should send up red flags.
Yeah.
There's no, you know, while when it comes out of the mouths of, you know, minorities who are anxious about displacement, I give it, you know, I listen. I stop and I listen and I say, you know, how do we mitigate those concerns? What can we do to support those people? When it comes out of the mouths of white homeowners, I'm like, you know, I'm sorry, but my sympathy is not very large.
Oh, and just so this might be surprising, Laura, the headline that I read for the 48 Hills article was an article by Zelda Bronstein,
oh, God,
who is in
woman.
Fact an elderly white homeowner.
She's the queen.
In Berkeley. So, you know, if there was any surprise ambiguity there.
Yep. I didn't know that. I saw her at an event the first time, and I didn't know. And I almost went up and like thanked her for telling me how I'm supposed to think.
No, I mean, it's just obscene. And it's obscene. I don't know if Norman Yee doesn't seem to have a firm grasp on policy all the time. I think that would be
any policy is a nice thing.
Him trying to have, like, to say we need family housing, insinuating that we need more housing of any kind, really. It's really frustrating to me.
Just how long has he been fighting adding housing in his district?
Well, you know, that's what his constituents want. You know, like a politician's job is to get reelected, right? Like that's the main thing. And I hate that that's what his constituents want. And I think that that's, if we're going to attack anything, that's what we need to go after.
Yeah. Right. But what do his constituents want? Like, it's not the case that they just want no housing construction, although they don't want housing construction. They also want the composition of the city to look differently than it does right now.
Yep.
And so it's a way to signal to them. It's like, hey, look, I don't like all these new people moving here either. I wish that it was a bunch of young families. Now, I'm not going to consider the ways in which my policy advocacy makes it so that young families can't really get a toehold here unless they're wealthy. But, you know, it's like a way to complain and to validate the anxiety and the fears and the anger of your residents.
And the senior housing that Christian Church Homes is trying to build, the Housing Action Coalition did a tour one Saturday of three 100% affordable senior buildings. And I joined them. And the van rides in between buildings were definitely the most productive part of the day. There were three vans, and, like, I sat in each one and talked to people from Forest Hill. And I said that we were talking about, like, what would the ground floor be? You know, what would the spaces be? And I was explaining that typically in 100% affordable, they're community spaces that the whole neighborhood gets to use. And it can be, like, a hub and people going in. And, you know, a guy looked at me, he's like, well, it's not a hub now. I don't see how it could possibly be a hub. And I was like, well, if we build a building there, you never know.
You know, but Sam, stepping back a little bit, right? So you're the executive director of Mission Housing. So
and
you're spending your time, doing this.
I don't think that's wasting my time.
Let's not just say wasting, but again, why is housing so expensive? This is one of the reasons why. Like, it, like the amount of time and effort that, that goes in to securing the approval of neighbors.
Well, I mean, I will say that a week later, one of those people started a We support the senior housing, like a webpage.
I'm not hopefully a petition. Not persuasive.
I hope a bunch of petition.org or whatever. Yeah.
That's great. But, you know, we've had this argument before. But that's wonderful. And I think it speaks to how good you are at your job. But it kills me that you have to spend the amount of brain space and time winning over these. You know, this is San Francisco is built on the premise that the squeaky wheel gets the oil, and it's built into our system front to back, and it means that people say, oh, you know, I'm going to listen to the community. But that's not actually what they're doing. They're not doing a poll of the entire community and saying, what does everyone think?
It's the loudest voices.
It's just the loudest voices. You're selecting for the most obnoxious person in the room, and you're saying, hey, if you get a really big stick to hit us over the head with, I'll listen to you.
So, you know, that's exactly right. But then becomes like this issue of, so how do we reform not just the entitlement process, but like how do we think about what it means to have community input into decisions that affect the community? So this is a question that I raised at the last Carla talk, where while we don't have great data on this, anecdotally, everyone you talk to, you know, says that the types of people that show up at, you know, these neighborhood development meetings or at city council meetings or zoning adjustment board meetings or what have you, they tend to be older, they tend to be whiter, they tend to be more likely to be homeowners. In other words, not at all representative of the community in which these decision makers should be, you know, like making their decisions based on a serve. But then, so what do you do with that information? To me, honestly, it seems like, you know what? I don't think there is an effective mechanism by which you can have a public process to gather all the voices that are impacted, because really then you would need to be surveying, like, you know, Guangdong or like wherever in China to figure out, okay, like what do like would-be Chinese immigrants want, what do people who are, you know, would-be tech workers in Ohio want. There's no real way to do that, and so I think my solution is just to cut out neighborhood involvement in development decisions.
And you make the decision. I mean, this is, you know, I know you Sam wants to cut in, but I think
and yet
that
you cut in it. Anyway.
I know, I did. The decision is made, like, how do you, for me, the question is, you have the most amount of community engagement during election season. That's when people all wake up and pay attention and make a decision. It's not Thursday afternoons at 3 o'clock, right? This is like, this is, how do we make decisions? It should be at the ballot box. People don't have, this is also why all the ballot props are completely fucked. But like, in general, you have to like take people at their word when they vote, not when they're squawking at 3 o'clock in the afternoon on Thursday.
So, I mean, when the project we're building above the Balboa BART station, it's 100 units, 100%, it's family, 100% affordable. We're going to take at least a year while we kind of design, you know, while we design the building. But we've started really small, local community meetings, you know, like these groups and everything. But we also put together a like community outreach committee, and we tried to pick as many different diverse people and make, it's like a 12 or 14 person committee, you know, homeowners, upper middle class, low income, like everything. And we're letting them decide who we go talk to, when we go talk to them, how we do it. And then we'll have two or three larger design, you know, like basically a pre-permit application meeting, but not officially. And that is, it's a lot of work, you know, it is. But I feel like, yeah, but I also feel like San Francisco, or even just everywhere, America, our generation is going back out to people and, you know, trying to combat this like passive aggressive racism and our desire to move back into the city. And I feel like we're making up for lost time. That's how it feels a lot while I'm out there.
So I think your advocacy efforts are absolutely valuable, and I think they seem to be effective. That's, I mean, I think our point though is that there's a fucking housing shortage, and the amount of time that we're spending this is just ridiculous.
That you are, in particular, a smart person.
Thank you.
Whose time could be spent building more units. And managing your building.
I think that is well, like when we go submit an application or when someone else, when Christian Church Homes tries to go submit the application, I think my time, that's a very good way to spend it, you know, preaching the gospel or whatever you want to talk, you know, call it. Because most people aren't like you two, so I know I talk about housing only, and you indulge me. Most people don't want to talk about it. But I feel when I leave the room, they want to a little bit more. And also, most of the community meetings have snacks, so that's cool.
I don't think we talked enough about the Republicans' Local Zoning Decisions Protections Act. I want people to really understand the true beauty of the Republicans coming out strongly in favor of local zoning control.
No, they're coming out to the rescue of all the Bay Area so-called progressives. I mean, right? Like, they're, like, afraid of the progress we've been making at the state level.
Greatest thing that ever could have happened for them.
Yeah.
You know, it, like, embodies all of the stuff they were too afraid to just come out and say, put in concrete words.
Yeah. So, okay, we can talk about this more, but, you know, I would love to have one of these so-called progressives on, if they would agree to come on our show, to talk about their advocacy in light of the advocacy from Trump, from Ben Carson, and from Republicans like Mike Lee. Because, you know, it's really, you know, it sounds the same, and the end is pretty much the same. Now, I think a lot of what they would say is that, well, my community isn't like that. Like, they have this idea that, you know, Berkeley wouldn't do that. Well, actually, Berkeley is, you know, losing its black population. Like, because right now, as is Oakland, as is San Francisco. Now, I'm not accusing these individual progressives of being bigots. I don't think most of them are.
Kind of are.
I'm sure some of them, I bet some of them are actual bigots. But I think a lot of them just don't understand the effects of their actions.
You know, it was interesting. So I had this conversation with Raphael Mandelman, who's going to be running for District 8 supervisor against the recently appointed Jeff Sheehy supervisor. So this is Scott Wiener's old district. And it was really fun because he calls me, used to call me a conservative. So we would run into each other and he would say, "Hey, conservative, wink, wink, nudge, nudge, I hate you." And I would be like, "I'm not conservative. Like, I fucking hate you." But I actually really like the guy. So I don't know. Anyway, I was really like, this guy really doesn't get it. He really doesn't get it. And so we sat down for like 2 hours over coffee. And we finally get to a point where he says, basically, like, "But I own a home." And he, you know, because and he's like, "But, and you're saying that things will look different."
That motherfucker.
Neighborhood character, guys. Neighborhood character.
Like, he was like, "Wait, but what you're saying is that things will look different." And I was like, "Yeah, Raphael, things will look different." And he was like, "Well, but then the view,"
"Who's the conservative here? I'm confused."
No, he admitted it. He finally, he said, "I guess actually you are the radical and I'm conservative." And I was like, "Thank you, Raphael.
So,
we've come to a consensus."
So here's like what I'll take. So Laura is going to have to spend at a minimum, 80 hours per person educating them. So provided that you can like live till, I don't know, 8,000 or something, then maybe we'll actually get somewhere in Bay Area politics.
Well, so he really does want to do right by poor people. In his heart, he does. But this is where I think a lot of the progressives who want to do right by poor people start from a place of defeatism, right? They start from the assumption, "We will never upzone the West Side. That's off the table. We're never really going to add a lot of housing. To say that we could really build enough housing is just a pipe dream. And so therefore, we should start under the premise that, like, basically we've already lost. And so we're talking about how we're going to allocate the existing housing stock."
Like the whole, "We need 100,000 units to actually affect supply and demand." Like, yeah, great, we do. But, if we build 50,000, that'll help also.
Or if we build 5,000 a year, that would help enormously. I mean, like these aren't linear relationships. So, yeah, like if we're talking about drastically lowering the rent, then yeah, sure, we need that much. But
same thing that like Norman Yee saying, "Where are all these? We need 4, you know, bedroom units." But he's saying it in the sense like, if you don't have that, then you shouldn't build anything else. And
yeah,
it's the same
so
thing.
So if you start with a defeatist attitude that it's already too late and we can't do really anything to make any real dent in it. I mean, I think that's, you know, it makes sense then to do focus on tenants' protections and say, okay, we have to care about the existing. I mean, I think there's also this bias of the progressives know that most people are not going to vote for them. And so there is a degree to which they want to choose their voters. They want to protect their existing voter base, and they don't want the new people who they know will not vote for them to come in and taint their voting base.
Yeah, so I think you're exactly right. Two things I want to comment on. One, the sense of choosing your voters, that is very much what's animating a lot of the so-called progressive movement in San Francisco. That's why they really focus on things like the percentage of affordable units and not the overall number of affordable units. They're really concerned with preserving some sort of voting base balance.
Yeah, the inclusionary units really crack me up. They're the smallest percentage of affordable housing that us or any other industry provides, but they, like a baby boomer, have the loudest voice. So I feel like there's a direct correlation there for sure. Yeah, the percentage of we get so wrapped up in it and it barely affects the number.
The other thing though is the defeatist angle. And as someone who has spent a number of years in, you know, either in left circles or at the margins of left circles, it's like part of this identity formation. The fact that we live in this irreconcilably conservative country, the country that just elected fucking Donald Trump of all people, that we're this sort of like remnant that, it, you know, is just going to be personally virtuous and fight the good fight knowing that we're going to lose. Now that's, that sort of attitude will never get you anywhere. But it seems that it's more about this sort of self-actualization of how my politics make me as an individual in this world than any sort of positive program for actually, how are we going to tackle the housing crisis? Because there's a way to do it. And you know what? It might make sense to look at this library of academic scholarship that's been bent on it. And that's like a conversation I had recently with someone who I think is broadly in agreement with us, but sometimes skeptical, a journalist, I won't name names. And
why not? This is the weird
This was an off the record conversation. And this, you know, I asked this person, like, you know, one of the things that frustrates me is housing disputes in San Francisco are reported as, you know, it's like shapes of the earth differ. You know, like people have different ideas of this, as if it were a matter of opinion, as if we just had competing theories. That's bullshit. Like, one of the things that environmentalists have been fighting for is, if you're going to talk about climate change, report the facts. Yeah, you can report the controversy. You can report what different factions said, but report the facts. And we can do that with housing scholarship as well. And that's something that I think we need to be pushing more in San Francisco. And then, you know, talk to our, you know, so-called progressives and be like, how do we, you know, get to what your values want, given this is the world.
And that's why I think going out and talking to them. You have a joke.
Okay, joke takes precedence. Yeah.
Yeah, joke takes precedence.
Agreed.
But Brian, then you're going to take away Zelda's alternative facts.
And you know, no one asked her if they can move
here. Yeah, here's the, you know what? Fuck Zelda's self-actualization. I could not care less about that rich, petty woman's, you know,
did you ask her if you could move here? Because I forgot to.
Yeah, yeah.
That's why she's mad at me.
My favorite is, who was it who was talking to Tim Redmond who admitted that he wanted basically an internal passport system, he wanted people
Tim Redmond wrote that on his blog. If you go to, like, Google Tim Redmond Stockton. I mean, I forget what phrase you get. Good to find it. I guess we could put it in the show notes. Tim Redmond wrote this whole blog post by saying that, you know, so if you're selling your house, you should be able to sell your house for whatever the market will bear. Anyone can move in because that doesn't result in displacement because you sell your own home. Funny, very convenient for homeowners like Tim Redmond to advocate that. But for rentals, you don't just get to rent for market rate. You know, we've got to control this. We need, you know, hyper control over our rental stock. And if you're coming here to work for Twitter, he called it Twitter specifically, you can wait in Stockton until a unit opens up for you. Now, I don't think Tim asked the people of Stockton what they thought.
Then
was
we would need more tech shuttles bringing people from Stockton.
We would need more housing in Stockton as well. I mean, like, Stockton does not... I mean, the whole thing is completely insane. But I kind of... This is, like, again, like, I liked it when Fernando Martí talks, because I feel like, you know, if you just let him talk and sort of poke at it a little bit, it all kind of falls apart. I mean, it is fascinating to me... You know, I this was not an off-the-record conversation, so I'll say. So Fernando lovely gave me a ride home that night, and that was very nice of him. And in the car ride home, he kind of asked me a little bit, like, why do we feel the need to poke the homeowners so much? And I was like...
That's what he was concerned about?
I was like, what game? I didn't, you know, I kind of like, I was like, what game do you think I'm playing here?
Why
like,
would you even ask me this?
And I realized that, like, sometimes, you know, I mean, I guess this is, we just have to keep talking and keep talking, right? Like, he really didn't get that, like, I actually, in my heart of hearts, I mean, though I care about all humans, I care about all humans equally, and I don't care if I poke the homeowners. I think that they're sitting on a big enough asset that they're gonna be fine. And I know that it's gonna hurt them in their little hearts to see their neighborhood physically change, but I don't know. I kind of think the housing of humans is more important.
Like, you know, I always feel the need to explain that the day, like, the way these boomer homeowners bought their homes, you know, minimum wage, getting a down payment, like all this stuff, like those are gone, you know? We're never going to enjoy it.
Right. That was never a thing. That, like, it actually was never a thing that you get, you know, minimum wage.
No, but you could get a loan. What I'm saying is the down payment even that's required now wasn't the same back then.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, if you look at, like, the multiples of median income that it takes to qualify for a mortgage now versus what it did 40 years ago. Yeah. I mean.
Or housing prices compared to the average income, right?
Exactly.
Like, that when I'm in the van with the Forest Hill senior, like, that's what I'm talking about. I'm explaining that, you know, look, I get that you love parking. It's just that there's this whole other generation that thinks about things differently. And we think about things differently because of the world you technically created for us.
And fucked up for us, right? Like,
well, I mean, I'd be polite.
Yeah,
I
don't say fuck. You say sir and ma'am. That's right.
Yeah. I mean, it is hard to say, like, you know, we do want to change this city. I don't think anyone should be under any kind of illusion. I love this city, and I want to make it more available for more people. And I think that we embrace this idea that we have to retrofit our city for the coming generations. We need a lot more transportation. We need public transportation. We went down this road of, and a literal road of car-centric infrastructure. And, you know, and that needs, we need to abandon that entire way of being, you know, which is part of what Trump's infrastructure policy terrifies me. But we need to get away from car-centric infrastructure. We need to build apartment buildings. Young and all people in dense urban environments are ready to scale down, are ready to say, we don't need big yards. We don't need single detached family homes in order to feel self-actualized. What we want is, especially when you have two working parents, to not have an hour-long commute, to be able to do it by public transportation instead of driving. Like, the things that add to, in general, millennials and other, and I think in general humans, like, sometimes I, you know, I sort of want to ask these boomers, like, are you really happy behind the wheel? Like, I don't think you are. I think you're yelling at the people in traffic with you. I don't think you're happy. I know you like your bumper stickers, but, like...
you got to be careful with those conversations, because then you might just convince them that they are, in fact, miserable. So, like, all of my...
You can't. You'll never... That's a non-starter.
That I've had with my, you know, dad about, like, mowing the lawn, you know, every week when it's not the winter.
Come in, watching Bill O'Reilly.
Bagging the leaves, you know, all the rest, sitting in traffic. And how many said, I was like, yeah, this sucks. I'm like, oh, shit, Dad. I wasn't trying to make you unhappy.
I'm trying to argue a political point here.
No, but my mom is super happy now that she lives in a little apartment. I mean, she just loves it. And she, you know, has more money for going out to eat. In the city she lives in, she doesn't drive herself anywhere. She takes transportation and taxis and whatnot, and has scaled down her life as a single person living in an urban environment to a size that makes a lot of sense for that. I admire her a lot for that.
Yeah, but so there's a really dangerous game, though, that we're playing here. The more that we convince the olds that this is the way to live, they have a lot more money than me. So they can just buy up all the existing urban property, and then we are doubly fucked. So we've got to be really careful how we play this. But one thing I don't know if this is a pivot or a non sequitur or what, but you mentioned Trump's infrastructure plan. Mm. And I'll tell you what, you know, frightens me about this. It's not just the graft. It's not just the fact that it's like, you know, more highways or bridges to nowhere or whatever. It's the way he's trying to split the union movement by working with the building trades unions in order to get this done. The reporting that came out after his meeting with the building trade head guys, where they were all like, Trump was enormously respectful, a lot of great ideas, we're excited with him. It's like, holy fuck. Mm-hmm. Like, you are really trying to just split the labor movement down the middle here.
Just like he split the rest of the country. Like,
yeah,
it's the same
and
move.
Like, this is like, but it's different in that, you know, much of labor was organizing against him. They were organizing for Hillary, and they could be a real non-government institutional check on his power. It's going to be a lot harder to do if, you know, Trumka of the AFL-CIO is busy just keeping his coalition, you know, in line and together as Trump is picking off individual unions that will specifically benefit from, like, the Dakota Access Pipeline or the Keystone XL Pipeline or building highways in the middle of nowhere or, like, what have you.
And, like, once they find out that there's hours, you know, there's jobs, especially the trustees, the people in the business managers that go and do these things, like, their job is to get as many hours, as much work as possible for their members. Like, that's it. Yeah. You know?
Well, there's a difference between, like, being a leader of specific unions and being, like, a union movement person, someone who cares about the movement of trade unionism. And these are very different things, and you have different incentives aligned. And, you know, the problem is
But like the people who went to go meet with Trump, the people who go to that, they are the ones that just go to get the hours.
I think you're right.
Yeah. And I mean, like, you know, whatever side note, like unions, my dad's an ERISA attorney. They put me through college. I learned how to be an asset manager by running union pension fund, real estate. So, I mean, I've definitely been around them a lot and I drink the Kool-Aid for sure.
My sister was a union organizer.
Nice. And I mean, they... You know, like the Beast on Bryant's a really good, that project in San Francisco is a really good point. Like, you know, Nick Podell said, I will hire all unions for the carpenter trades. And the carpenters just went right onto his side, done and done. You know, when the majority of those carpenters, you know, aren't going to, like, that wasn't a good project for them. You know, they were building stuff that, like, they might have to leave the city because of it. And, that's like something that stuck with me a lot because, I mean, you know, they need to get work. Like that's all it is. You know, they need hours to work. And people in the Mission neighborhood were mad at them for, you know, whatever, being a traitor or anything. But like to me, it's like, what do you expect? Like he's saying he's going to hire them. You know?
Yeah. Well, there's also a little bit of a difference with that specific story in that the fact of the matter is most building trades unions are pretty fucking busy right now in the Bay Area. Mm-hmm. A lot of their numbers were decimated in the housing crisis before. And so they're able to sort of play a different political game now than they were able to play 10 years ago.
But, I mean, parts aren't. I mean, you know, those people that went to – no one from the Bay Area went to go meet with Trump.
Yeah.
Because they're all – like you said, they're all riding high. But there's a lot of other areas of the country that –
absolutely right.
Could use the hours.
Absolutely, you know? Right. And, you know, of course, like, my reaction, and maybe this wasn't fair, was, you know, fucking building trades, because, like, those are the people who are preventing us from getting buy right in California. You know,
but, I mean, if Jerry Brown just would have said prevailing wage union local hire, that's all he had to do. And they wouldn't have been against it.
Yeah, but remember, though, then we're talking about is prevailing wage, local hire, sewer hookups, school fees, park and rec fees, inclusionary zoning requirements, you know, on and on and on. And then it's like, wait a minute, housing only pencils if you can sell it for $800,000 a unit. That's a fucking disaster, and that's no good policy. And like Jerry Brown gets that, and so I think, you know,
well, but
I think,
Jerry,
like,
Brown,
all of us, all of our sympathies are pro union. Like my mother was involved with her union, credits that was saving her job. Like, I'm like a very pro union movement person, even though I really disagree with some specific unions in the Bay Area and in California.
I mean, I was just gonna say, look, I mean, I think the biggest problem with Jerry Brown's buy right was that he is clinically incapable of compromising.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, he says my way or the highway. And, you know, my
and
way,
it's ironic
and that,
that he
work.
It's ironic that he always says that one of his biggest frustrations is that the local municipalities won't compromise. They won't, you know, come to the table. You know, like, that's what he said, the $400 million that he quote unquote took away from affordable housing developers that definitely never existed ever. He said, if you don't show me that you will compromise, you know, if you don't come to the table, then I'm going to take it away. And he really is, you know, he's iron.
So, look, I'm not going to comment on, you know, Jerry Brown's negotiating or try to, like, defend it. I don't.
Why not?
I don't even know that much about the specifics. But what I will say, though, is
this is peanut gallery
the general,
time.
The general idea, though, of saying, look, if you want more money for affordable housing, we need to make it cheaper to build this housing. That's a correct idea.
Okay, so before you're getting way off topic, I want us to circle back to Trump. I want to circle back to the Republicans, but also to the fact that, there's a ton. You've come up with new things for me to be depressed about in Trump's America. So thank you for that one, Brian.
You're welcome.
I really appreciate it. I wasn't crying enough, so thank you. And on the note of hysterical and crying and being completely freaked out is San Francisco's status as a sanctuary city and everyone really freaking out about a recent incident where ICE showed up at Sam, you're one of your projects.
Yeah, it was one of our family buildings, Good Samaritan Apartments. it's over on like 26th and Potrero. Outer Mission, around 8:30 or so, two men showed up, unannounced, without notice to us or the police of San Francisco or anyone. They showed up, they didn't say it initially, but they essentially told some people they couldn't get into the building because we have a gate and it's locked. And the property manager wasn't there at the time. So there's a preschool in the same building, and the head of the preschool came out and asked them what they were doing, and they said that essentially that they had a tip that there was someone that, you know, shouldn't be in the country, basically. And I don't have all the information. It's still an ongoing thing. We're you know, more stuff's coming in every few hours or whatever. But it's really scary. We've been mobilizing. We have a plan that we're cultivating for educational and resource fairs at our buildings, and we're going to roll those out over the next few weeks. But I will admit that I feel bad because, you know, like, the buck stops with me, and I thought we had a few more weeks. I truly thought we were mobilizing, we're going to get this done, like, and this was like day six, you know, and this ICE showed up. So
yeah.
I got caught off guard for sure.
So, I mean, we've already offered all the YIMBY's volunteering and doing whatever we can and trying to get resources together and helping throw a fundraiser, sort of whatever you guys end up deciding is needed. I mean, you know our resources pretty well. But I'm wondering how unusual, I mean, one thing that's been hard to gather from the news is sort of like, you know, this seems shocking.
Yeah, it's unprecedented. There's been not even a handful of incidents in the past with ICE coming into San Francisco. And I'm just kind of learning about all that. So, I mean, for them to show up unannounced and, you know, forget not telling us, you know, not telling the police is, that's breaking protocol, basically. But we're gonna handle it. We'll deal with it. But I will admit that I'm not sure that this was in the job description when I first signed up, but I'm glad that it is now. I mean, look, Mission Housing, we're strong enough financially, capacity-wise, human-wise, like we can do this. We're working with La Raza, Central Legal, and other immigrant defense firms to. I feel like we need to standardize what mm-hmm. are your rights and how to respond. The more I learn about it, it seems like ICE preys on fear and not knowing what to do. You know, people being confused and scared. And the more we can educate people, the less that will happen.
Yeah, I mean, so I know next to nothing about this other than what I read on Twitter, right, which isn't all that much. But ACLU sent out a brief guide, like, what do you do when they mm-hmm. show up? And one is like, you know, one, don't open the door. Mm-hmm. You know, demand to see a warrant signed by a judge. They can slip it underneath the door or through a mail slot if you have that, or if there's a window, put it up against that. Now, mm-hmm. if they force their way in, don't resist, you know, all the rest. But, you know, there are folks who are working on this problem right now. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Sam, I hope you get all the help that you need.
Yeah, and they've been great, like the ACLU. A lot of people, you know, if anything, it's what I always say about Mission Housing. Like, we have about 38 buildings. They all have community rooms. Like, we can be a hub for people to go to and learn things. And I think we're in a unique situation where we are a private landowner, a private developer, and it's our tenants that they're, you know, coming for. But we are the owner of the building, so we get to our precedent, our rights. Mm-hmm. They need to come to us to get access. And in that regard, we can kind of be like the first line of defense or a shield for
sort of like
the tenants.
Literal gatekeepers.
Literally, we're gatekeepers, yeah.
And for YIMBYs, you know, we're going to be much more organized about our YIMBY Action membership, and so we'll have people's addresses and phone numbers and give people the opportunity to be on a rapid response team that can be for people who live close to these buildings especially, or can inform us that they work close. You know, and we're going to be also deploying people to help out with getting things permitted and whatnot, which is really why we are collecting people's addresses. I hope you'll put your address into the YIMBY Action form, because being close is really helpful. Mm-hmm. We may be doing canvassing in the area to help inform people of these resources and their rights. But, you know, it's going to be something that, you know, Trump is making it very clear that he intends to attack our sanctuary city. And YIMBY's part of our core identity is people who are deeply supportive of immigration.
Yes, in my backyard is not just about housing. That's the thing that I like the most about it, you know?
We don't, you know, we're not, you know, fighting to build empty houses in our backyard. We're fighting to build houses for people, you know, in our backyard.
Side note, though, I would prefer not to have a backyard and have an accessible dwelling unit.
It's a metaphorical backyard.
I'd like an ADU in the backyard.
Yeah.
Fully up to code, of course.
Yeah. But I think, you know, this is about humans. And this is about our neighbors, our potential neighbors, about bringing people into the community, about making our communities more accessible for people of all kinds of backgrounds, income levels, you know, integration and supporting the human beings who live in our communities are core values. And it's not something that we are going to let Trump, you know, we're going to be fighting. Yeah.
I'm in. Sold.
Yeah. You know, I saw getting lunch today at Analog in Oakland. I saw some, you know, white punk guy with a t-shirt on, and I forget the exact wording, but it was like, I will do my best to defend you against bigots. You know what I mean? And I think that's the sort of like a great motto, I think, for all of us to live by, is this notion of solidarity and doing whatever we can to help out those.
And you know, like, I mean, I try to use my white privilege wherever I can. I have it. I might as well use it. And people figure that out.
Yeah, I should really stop just using my white privilege so I can drink wine in parks, right?
Well, and not be hassled by police. Look like someone that should be doing that, though, so you got to play the part.
Yeah.
Oh, man. All right. Well, thank you so much for coming on and giving us an update. I know that you guys at Mission Housing will be sending out things on Twitter, and you know, I'm sure there'll be more news articles, mm-hmm. Maybe some that are a little more accurate coming out soon.
That'd be helpful.
Yeah. So we'll keep people informed.
Thank you.
All right. And see you next week.
Bye.